Star Wars or Doctor Who? Star Wars or Doctor Who? Star Wars or Doctor Who?
His name is Rob.
His name is Rob.
He knows his Wookiees from his Daleks. Listen now.
Listen now.
Hear the Force challenge the TARDIS. Get your blue milk and jelly babies while we see which drives you crazy. Star Wars or Doctor Who?
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Who Wars, the podcast for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who. This is episode 7, and I'm your host, Rob Irwin, and I'm just sitting here in my hot little studio in Sydney. It's very hot today, although it's going to get hotter as summer hits, and I'm thinking, how was your week? My week was pretty good. I've had some really, really interesting conversations on Twitter with people this week. I guess one of the most interesting has been with a lot of Clone Wars fans out there. Star Wars Clone Wars, the TV series that got cancelled probably about a season and a half or two seasons before its final goal of telling the full story it wanted to tell. And a lot of people are really, really bitter about this. It doesn't affect me at all in the sense that I gave up on Clone Wars around season 2 or 3 or whatever it was, because it was just a bit silly and a bit kiddie. And as I've said several times in these podcasts, yes, yes, I know it got better. I know it got more interesting. I know there are some amazing storylines apparently later on in the run. I've just never seen them. So I don't have the emotional investment that a lot of these folk I was talking to have. And I guess to some degree I felt I was being the voice of reason in these conversations, because these people are saying, you know, bring back Clone Wars, Disney, bring back Clone Wars. And I'm saying, guys, I don't think Disney's going to bring back Clone Wars. They've moved on. The show is cancelled. We have Rebels. People from Clone Wars are now working on Rebels. Clone Wars isn't coming back. And I had people say, oh, but what about what they just released? All those storyboards and, you know, those half-finished episodes. What about that? And I'm like, well, guys, if anything, that's proof that it's not coming back. Because if there was a scrap of an idea or a scrap of a hope that they were going to bring it back, they'd be keeping that pretty close to their chests at the moment, because they'd be working on that and working them up into finished episodes. They wouldn't be just tossing them out there and saying, here's what's left, have a look. You know, but such is the passion that these people have. I had someone saying, no. That's because they want to judge people's reactions. They want to see if people are still keen for Clone Wars. That's why they put that out there. And, you know, this person apparently thinks if a lot of people like those half-finished episodes, Clone Wars will somehow magically come back into existence. And that's like telling me the Earth is flat. You know, it just won't happen. I tried saying this to a few folk, and then I had people coming back and saying, oh, well, what about, you know, this and that, and what about these lost episodes? And yeah, that's fine, guys. But when it comes to new ongoing Clone Wars, if they're tossing out the scraps of what was left, they're not going back to it. Maybe, I don't even want to say this, but maybe they'll go back to it in 10 years' time or something and think, oh, this might be a fun area to explore again. But in the shorter term, it's not going to happen. Their focus is on Rebels, and it will be for probably 5 years at least. As I said to these guys, you know, we may get the remaining storylines told in novels or something like that, and that will round out the series. But sitting there all day, every day, getting on Twitter and writing these messages out into the ether to Disney and anyone else who's, you know, following you on Twitter and saying, bring back Clone Wars, it's not going to happen. I mean, spend your life doing that all day if you like, but it's not going to eventuate in anything. And maybe in 5 years' time, you'll look back and think, geez, I wasted a lot of my life thinking, hoping Clone Wars would come back. TV, as I said to these guys, is sometimes a really harsh mistress. TV shows do end suddenly sometimes. They do get cancelled, and there's no resolution. It happens. It's par for the course on TV, and just because something is Star Wars doesn't make it immune from that happening to the franchise. It can happen to Star Wars as easily as it can happen to Firefly or any other great TV series that got, you know, axed before its time. Fans always think it's before its time. Of course they do. That's what makes you fans. That's what makes you passionate. But you've sometimes got to take a step back. And for me, it's easy because, as I mentioned earlier, I don't have this fully emotional attachment to Clone Wars. So I can see it. I can take that step back and say, guys, it's not coming back, okay? But I can also understand on an intellectual level that someone who is emotionally invested in it and who sees what could have been with these other episodes may still be in this phase where they're just in denial that it's gone and can't believe that it won't not come back. But it's gone. It's gone. Anyway, moving on, sticking with the CG theme and Star Wars on TV, Star Wars Rebels. I was talking to other people this week about my theory for Rebels, and this comes up in the review later in this episode, a review I must say that I do in tandem with my wife. My wife is never keen to talk on podcasts or do anything like this, so I'm really, really pleased and proud that she decided to do this. She jumps on and talks Star Wars Rebels with me, and we talk about this theory that I was discussing earlier this week, basically putting it out there that I think in 5 years' time, Rebels will end with the crew of the Ghost stealing the plans for the Death Star, loading them into R2-D2, sending him on his way to Princess Leia to tie into the start of A New Hope, and maybe to stop them being any kind of encumbrance in the Star Wars A New Hope timeline onwards, maybe they'll hang back, maybe they'll fight Darth Vader, maybe they'll get wiped out doing that, they'll go out in a blaze of glory, having sent the plans off to Leia. And in my mind, that couldn't be a better ending to Star Wars Rebels. You know, after we see these people fight the Empire for 5 years, they then do the ultimate. They get those Death Star plans, which leads to Luke Skywalker destroying the Death Star in Star Wars Episode 4. I can't think of a better tie-in. So I've been talking to people on Twitter about that this week, and I do discuss it in the review later with my wife. So I won't say too much more about it here, but that was a very, very interesting online conversation that that I had this week. What else? Also on Twitter this week, I spoke about having interaction with Freddie Prinze Jr. and Vanessa Marshall on the Star Wars side of things, and Neil Gaiman on the Doctor Who side of things. And this week I had some more interaction. I actually had some more interaction with Freddie just earlier today, actually, where one Twitter user who I hope will contribute to the show in weeks ahead, Lady Destrus, was saying to him about who Kanan's Jedi Master is. And Freddie was being a bit cagey and not giving a response. And I remembered Freddie a few weeks back was saying that I thought he had said it was Mace Windu. And so I jumped in and said, hey, Freddie, a few weeks back you said it was Mace Windu. He came back to me, copied in Lady Destrus, and said, ah, yeah, it's in the line of Mace Windu, but it's not Mace Windu himself. So there's maybe a bit of a tidbit of information. It looks like Kanan Jarrus in Star Wars Rebels has been trained by possibly one of Mace Windu's apprentices. That's interesting. Go and have a look at who some of Mace Windu's apprentices are, and maybe you can even narrow it down further to who trained Kanan Jarrus. I thought that was quite fun. Also, I do this from time to time. I pull out interesting things from my Star Wars or Doctor Who collections, and I photograph them and post them up. And one of the things I tossed up this week is a celebration for VIP pass, and it's been signed by Billy D. Williams. And so I tossed that up there and said, hey, look at this, it's a VIP pass from Celebration 4, signed by Billy D. Williams. It's a favourite sort of item in my autograph collection, because I have a lot of Star Wars autographs, I've got to say. Most of them are very traditional on, you know, 8x10 photographs, that kind of thing. But to have actually a piece of, I guess you could call it ephemera, from Celebration 4, this VIP pass, I don't know who owned it originally, but Billy D has signed it, and I thought that was cool. And anyway, Billy D Williams favorited that tweet. I thought that was just awesome. You know, when Lando Calrissian comes after you on Twitter to favorite one of your tweets about him, that's just fantastic. Okie dokie, moving on to some fan feedback over the past week. And I had M.A. Tamburo, who's the director and producer of Doctor Who Dark Journey, send me a little message. You can find M.A. Tamburo at AM Audio Media on Twitter. The message there was very short and simple. Love the podcast. We'll tune in every Sunday. Keep up the great work. I thought that was really nice. So we had a bit of a conversation, as is my wont. If anyone takes the time to send me a tweet or a personal direct message on Twitter or whatever it might be, I always try and reply. You know, we're not one of these podcasts that's big enough or cliquish enough to just ignore people when they take the time to do that. And we got into a conversation about the work on Doctor Who Dark Journey, which I've got to say is a very, very interesting project. It sounds very professional. It's got an interesting storyline. Basically, if you look at the first episode, the Doctor meets Sherlock Holmes. Not the Benedict Cumberbatch modern Sherlock Holmes. This is Sherlock back in the day, and the Doctor and Sherlock team up to stop Jack the Ripper and all that kind of good stuff. But there is a greater evil at work in Victorian England at the time. I'm going to say a lot more about Doctor Who Dark Journey in our next episode, but I just wanted to throw it out there that I got this piece of feedback about M.A. Tamburo loving the show and all of that, and that's wonderful. And I just wanted to throw out these addresses for now, such as www.amaudiomedia.com or facebook.com/amaudiomedia, or as I mentioned earlier, twitter.com/amaudiomedia, and you can start finding the links into these audios. I mean, if you like Big Finish type audios and you want to hear an alternate Doctor having this adventure in Victorian England, tune in, check it out. I will say a lot more, though, in the next episode. Another bit of feedback this week came from 50DW50, who you can find on Twitter at 50DW50. I guess that handle must have came up in homage to the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who last year. And the message is, enjoyed podcast 8, thanks. There was no house left next to the barn because Lungbarrow buried itself after the Doctor left. Hashtag so there. And I've had a bit of back and forth with 50DW50 on this. He or she didn't mean podcast 8 because we haven't actually got to podcast 8. They were going off the date of the podcast, so that's fine. And the house they're referring to is the house that we saw in the recent Doctor Who episode Listen. We were tossing around this idea that when the Doctor went back to Gallifrey or wherever that barn is, everything else was not there. You know, what had gone on. And I think Lex might have been talking about this a bit as well as myself. And what 50DW50 is saying is that Lungbarrow buried itself after the Doctor left. If you're not familiar with Lungbarrow, look it up. It's one of the Virgin adventures. If you throw it into Wikipedia or something like that, you'll get some information on it. I guess Lungbarrow isn't really considered canon anymore, but I do like the way 50DW50's reached back there and came up with a possible idea to tie in Lungbarrow to the modern episodes of Who. Okay, one last bit of feedback this week comes from Ben Rush, who you can find on Twitter at Ben110173. I guess a lot of the other Bens were taken when Ben went for that Twitter handle. And he says, okay, new fave of the series. It had everything I wanted from a story with added jelly babies. Squeal! And what Ben's referring to there is Mummy on the Orient Express, which is the Doctor Who episode which aired today and which I have a review of later in this episode. There was a very cool scene with jelly babies. I think I might not have even mentioned it in my review, but it was great. The Doctor pulls out what appears to be a cigarette case. I thought he was going to offer this fellow a cigar or something. When he opened it, it was full of jelly babies. That was quite cool. And it was a great episode too. Ben says it's his favourite of the series so far. I'm not sure I'd go that far, but it was a really, really good episode. All right, that's enough for feedback. This is a big episode, a lot of cool content, so let's get into it. But before we do, remember, folks, we do welcome comments on Twitter, like the ones I've just been reading out, email, of course, Facebook, or even an MP3. Why not record yourself? And we'll use that on the show. I love when people use their own voices to ask questions or make comments. Go for it. Don't be shy. Details on how to send that in to me are all at the end of the show during the closing credits. And now, without any further ado, it's time for my top stories of the week. Alrighty then, moving into my top stories of the week. And as always, I like to start with the Star Wars Episode 7 rumours and commentary and sometimes just news that surrounds Episode 7. Not all of it is spoilerific, but as I always say, if you're a spoiler phobe of any kind of persuasion, it might be best just to skip forward past this segment. Have a look at the show notes, you'll see what times everything is happening at, and just skip past it, because if you're going to be spoiled, I don't want to be the one who did it. But for the rest of you who like, you know, speculation and hearing different things, and even just hearing news about Episode 7, let's get into it. I guess one of the most exciting things I heard this week about Episode 7 was that John Williams will be beginning work on the soundtrack in about 2 weeks' time. There was a chap wrote into the website makingstarwars.net, and he said that he went to see the John Williams symphony in Milwaukee, and apparently at that symphony he confirmed he's starting on the Episode 7 soundtrack in 2 weeks' time, which is just immense news. I mean, it's obviously a given. As long as John Williams is alive and making music, he will be doing the Star Wars movies, that's for sure. I think maybe even when he's not doing music, he might still try and help a future composer, because he is just so intrinsically Star Wars in the way he thinks and scores. I mean, he's written many great scores in his time for all kinds of different movies, some really, really beautiful work. But with Star Wars, he just has that connection. You know, it's hard to imagine Star Wars without the music of John Williams in it. It was probably one of the biggest masterstrokes. I mean, between getting someone like Ralph McQuarrie to design the world and getting someone like John Williams to score it, I think they're some of the key components in what made Star Wars a success. Of course, there was more to it than that, but they are just huge pillars. So I'm very excited to hear this news. John Williams beginning work in 2 weeks on the score. Also during this week, we had a snapshot of a poster from the Episode 7 set. It's got Darth Vader's gloved hand reaching out from one side of the image, putting his hand over the mouth of an Imperial officer whose hat's falling off the back of his head. You know, Darth is obviously grabbing him with some force, no pun intended. And the title is Loose Lips Bring Down Starships. It's a parody, I think, on World War II propaganda posters where people would be reminded not to, you know, talk about things they shouldn't be talking about. And we first heard of this, gosh, months ago now, when Kevin Smith, the comedian Kevin Smith, also responsible for movies like Clerks and so on, he got up at Comic Con, and he's done it at a couple of other places, and spoke about going to the Episode 7 set and stepping onto the Millennium Falcon and having quite a profound emotional experience and all that kind of stuff. In a couple of those stories he's told, he's mentioned the Loose Lips Bring Down Starships poster, and here we're actually seeing it. So some people are pointing out that the image itself of this poster is a leak, and it's Loose Lips in a way. I'm not so sure. I think with Kevin Smith having mentioned it months ago, seeing it now is not such a big reveal, but certainly very cool to see it. I know some people have taken it and cleaned up the image and made it into desktop wallpaper and all sorts of fun stuff, so good fun. I wonder if it'll become a poster for sale perhaps when Episode 7 gets out there. There was a little story in the Daily Mail this week about Harrison Ford. It mentioned that he's really set to complete his filming duties on Episode 7 very, very soon. And it showed him walking around the streets of London on a mobile phone. He's dressed in a dinner suit, a tuxedo of some kind, apparently in Notting Hill, which is a very nice area of London. I'm wondering why he's out walking around. He's not out there having a smoke or anything. Maybe his car didn't come to pick him up or something. He doesn't look too impressed being photographed, but I don't think Harrison looks too impressed in public at the best of times. What I take away from these images is his hair. He's grown his hair to a really shaggy kind of Empire Strikes Back / Return of the Jedi look for Han Solo. Obviously, we've seen some pictures of him recently, but here I think his hair is at its longest. It's still very grey. Obviously, he's going to wear it grey in the film, like he did in the last Indiana Jones film as well. Very proud of the fact he's grey. He's not going to dye it and try and look younger. And I guess I like pictures like this of the stars out in public, whether it's Mark Hamill with his messy hair and beard, or here it's Harrison, just to get a sense of what they might look like in the film. Yeah, I thought that was very cool. Speaking of what Harrison might look like in the film, there was another piece on Making Star Wars just recently that harked back to some of the earlier images that had popped out of what Han's costumes might look like in the film. I think that was stuff that might have went up originally on Indie Revolver, where we saw a almost Hoth-like outfit in one of them, and in another a very traditional Han Solo shirt and pants with a very long trench coat. I think Americans might refer to it as a duster. And yeah, look, I think they've they've nailed the Han Solo look. They're not doing anything too outlandish or bizarre. The MakingStarWars.net story, though, does mention that there's a new coat kind of making its way into some of the production art, and it looks very similar, allegedly, to a coat that George Lucas wore on the set of Star Wars Episode 4. You've probably seen it where he's out in the desert in Tunisia, or even back in the studios in the UK. It's a brown coat, comes down just a bit past the waist, so longish, and it's got big, wide, sheepskin-looking furry lapels. It's a deeply 70s coat, so I'll be very keen to see how closely, if this coat makes it into the film at all, that it does look like this George Lucas coat from the 70s. I don't know if it's meant to be a deliberate homage or whether it's just the people over at MakingStarWars.net thinking it's a fun sort of connection. I'm not too sure, but yeah. That's it for the Star Wars Episode 7 news this time around, but of course there's tons more Star Wars news in general. Obviously, we've just had New York Comic Con, and Marvel were there and talking about not just the Marvel comics we know are coming in the new year, obviously three series, one of them being a Princess Leia comic, for example, one of them being an ongoing Star Wars comic, and one of them being a Darth Vader comic. And they revealed they're going to be doing another comic, an ongoing comic at that, not just a mini-series, called Star Wars Kanan, to serve as a prequel to Star Wars Rebels and give us more detail on Kanan Jarrus. Not the Kanan Jarrus, I guess, that popped up in the A New Dawn novel, where we got some background on him, but this is Kanan Jarrus during the Clone Wars era. And after Freddie Prinze Jr. was talking about the lineage of Mace Windu and maybe one of his apprentices being his master, it does pop up in this news story that it looks like Kanan's master during the Clone Wars era was Deepa Bilaba. And this comic series will explore his relationship with Deepa Bilaba and how Kanan survived Order 66 and basically the evolution from Padawan to Freedom Fighter. It's a very interesting sounding story, and actually Rebels executive producer and writer Greg Weissman, the fella who we believe isn't actually continuing on Rebels in Season 2, will script the first story arc of the comic with Pepe Larraz illustrating. So for those of you out there who know Greg's work or Pepe's work or people who are just interested in Star Wars Rebels, look out for this around April 2015, Star Wars Kanan. It does sound a long way away, but I tell you what, it's probably going to creep up quicker than we know. Moving on, some of you might remember a project from some years back called Star Wars Uncut. The plan there was to chop up Star Wars into small sections of film and then ask people to recreate those sections of film in any way they saw fit, whether to dress up and reenact them or maybe draw something or maybe play with their action figures and recreate the scene or do some CGI or, you know, whatever people could do to take a scene and send in their clip. I had a go at Star Wars Uncut. I submitted a little piece on Tatooine with Luke in his land speeder. People could submit multiple scenes, so I was up against, I think, two or three other people who had done the same scene, and mine didn't end up getting used in the first Star Wars Uncut, so I was a little miffed. No, I really wasn't. It was fine. And what we've got now this week is a new project, The Empire Strikes Back Uncut, has been released. I didn't even know this was happening. I guess in the back of my mind I should have known they were working on it, but I hadn't submitted anything to this or anything of that nature. And so it's quite fun for it to pop out fully formed. And I was watching some of it earlier, and it's just great. You know, the combination of artwork and live action and action figures and toys and all sorts of fun stuff that people have done to create The Empire Strikes Back, bit by bit. It's all stitched together. There's, you know, instrumental music in the background. It's a movie you can actually watch. Slightly schizophrenic kind of movie to watch, but one you can watch nevertheless. It's very, very cool. We'll finish up with a couple of Doctor Who stories now. Earlier this week, we learned that Robert Downey Jr. is quite envious of Benedict Cumberbatch's version of Sherlock. And if he were a pizza, he'd be a garlic, extra cheese, onion, spinach, and pepperoni pizza. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. On his Reddit Ask Me Anything thread that he did earlier this week, Robert responded to a user who asked whether he would go for a role in Doctor Who if he had the chance. And his answer is quite interesting. Robert said, "It's funny you'd bring that up. A writer asked me to watch a particular episode about a month ago in hopes of helping us break a story on a project. An incredible series. Anything's possible." So, what does that mean? I guess it means he's not coming to Doctor Who. It means he had to watch Doctor Who for this other project he was putting together, but that he quite liked it. I'd like to know which episode it was now. Was it, you know, one of the classic mainstays that everyone recommends, like Blink, or was it just something completely out of the box, you know, and he watched it and thought it was good? Was it Smith and Jones, or The Unicorn and the Wasp, or The Pandorica Opens? Who knows? But Robert Downey Jr. has watched Doctor Who, thinks it's great, and I guess it's got everyone wondering what sort of role he'd play in Doctor Who. For me, as much as I like Robert Downey Jr., I mean, I'm a bore when I talk about this, but I'm one of those few people who actually believed in him in those years where he got on the drugs and, you know, fell on the wrong side of the law. I'd tell everyone who'd listen, this guy's a great actor. He's quite a guy. If he can clean up his act, he'll just be fantastic. And eventually he did, of course, and the rest is history. So I'm a big fan of Robert Downey Jr., don't get me wrong. But I wouldn't like to see someone of that caliber on Doctor Who. Even when we look back to the classic series and we see City of Death with John Cleese having a cameo, I think it just really takes us right out of the episode. Well, me at least. I shouldn't say we, because I guess there are people out there who see John Cleese in City of Death and think it's fantastic. You know, I sit there though thinking, oh, it's John Cleese. I'm taken right out of this now. I can't believe in this imaginary world because you've stuck John Cleese in the middle of it. So, unless they put him in a mask or they did something, you know, profound or just use his voice or something like that, unless they did that, and then, you know, why use him if no one can tell it's him? I don't like seeing big names in Doctor Who. Even someone like this Foxes person who popped up in Mummy on the Orient Express, I've got no idea who Foxes is. I've never heard one of her songs. So, to me, it was just someone singing on the train and singing a Queen song at that, so that was quite fun. But if Foxes was Lady Gaga or something, and they were like, Lady Gaga is on Doctor Who? No. Whether it's Doctor Who or movies in general, the more no-names who you can get in there and who I can just totally immerse myself in the story and not be distracted by, oh, this is such and such big name playing this role, oh, this is Tom Cruise playing this role, or Brad Pitt or whatever, I'd much rather see no-names in roles wherever possible, so in a roundabout way, I wouldn't like to see Robert Downey Jr. in Doctor Who, but it's just something people have been talking about this week after that Reddit conversation. Finally, there's a great story in Radio Times at the moment asking, who is Gus? And I guess similar to when we asked, who is Missy? I guess a lot of people from tonight's episode of Doctor Who, Mummy on the Orient Express, are asking, who is Gus? It was just this disembodied voice, you know, no physical form, just this disembodied posh voice. You know, it was John Sessions, who a lot of UK people will know and who we know down here through his appearances on QI and so on. And it was really interesting. Who is he? I mean, he obviously has the Doctor's phone number, which the Radio Times article says is arguably not much of an achievement these days. Everyone from a random banker he met once to Winston Churchill seems to have the number. But mysterious figures ringing the TARDIS seems to be a theme recently, with the Doctor keen to find out who's giving out his details. Now, we know a strange woman in a shop gave Clara the Doctor's number back in The Bells of St. John. That was the episode about the Wi-Fi turning evil. Gosh, it was silly. I think that was the one where the Doctor drove the motorbike up the side of the building as well. And you wonder why I don't like Series 7? Anyway, I digress. With many assuming that the shopkeeper was probably Missy, the gatekeeper of the Nethersphere. Now, if this is true, could Gus maybe be one of Missy's henchmen, perhaps, and thus part of the series arc? I mean, we've heard of Gus before, I guess in a roundabout sort of way. If you think back to 2010's series finale, The Big Bang, Matt Smith got a call on the phone, and part of that conversation ran, well, no, I get that it's important, an Egyptian goddess loose on the Orient Express, in space, give us a mo. So, although it wasn't an Egyptian goddess on the Orient Express in space, maybe that was this Gus person, or maybe it's Missy pretending to be Gus, luring the Doctor in. As Capaldi said in Mummy on the Orient Express, he's tried to entice me before, free tickets, mysterious summons, he even phoned the TARDIS once. And that's referring back to that moment in The Big Bang. So whoever Gus is, he's been playing some sort of long game, so I don't think that's going to be the last we hear of him. I think it's been set up too well for it to be nothing. But as to who Gus is it Missy? Is it someone who works for Missy? Who knows? Some people have pointed out that Gus is part of the word sarcophagus, and there was a sarcophagus in the episode, you know, that they were going to put the mummy into, allegedly. I know Stephen Moffat likes, you know, plays on words with the whole Amy Pond and River Song and all that kind of stuff. We even brought that up last episode or the episode before with Missy perhaps being short for Mississippi, because Missy is River Song. It'll be interesting to find out who Gus really is, because I'm sure, as I said a moment ago, it is going to come up again. Anyway, that's it for my top stories of the week. Some interesting stuff in there. If you've got any comments on these, throw me a line on Twitter or an email or whatever you like, and we'll talk about them some more. There's some interesting things happening out there. All right, let's move on.
Hey guys, it's me, Kate. Have you noticed the amount of Star Wars Episode 7 spoilers rapidly increasing? Yeah, me too. So much so that it caused me to tweet this earlier this week. I said, at this point, I'm just getting sick of Star Wars Episode 7 spoilers, in quotation marks, wake me up when there's something real. So granted, that day I was a little restless and sassy, but I still hold to that, and let me explain to you why. Now, a few of these points have already been touched on by Rob in previous podcasts, so bear with me. But my first point is the concept art. The concept art, which is just that. It's a concept. Now, some of it might be used in what we see in the final movies, but a lot of it is just the artist's imagination running wild. And when you're designing something, designing anything, you start out with several varied options, and a lot of those ideas will eventually get scrapped, and you won't even see them at all. I think people are getting way out of hand with all of this concept art, and they need to really put that into perspective. So my next point, the so-called leaks. What do I have to say about that? Well, I'm guessing that Bad Robot has hired somebody to deliberately leak false information, maybe even some real stuff once in a while, to throw us off our scent. I think we'll all be really surprised when Episode 7 comes out and it's so different than what we thought it would be. JJ, he knows how to keep a secret, and I'm pretty sure he goes to bed each night laughing his head off at us. With all these recent rumors and so-called spoilers, for me, it's just getting frustrating. I mean, most of what we're seeing right now is probably either fake or it's not even going to be in the movie. But, you know, even the rumor that we had last week about the big rumor, you know the one I'm talking about. That doesn't even really feel like a spoiler to me at this point. Who knows, maybe it will be. To me, it just seemed like it's still rumor territory. So when I thought that it was going to be a real spoiler too, I was still conflicted at whether I was going to be looking at spoilers from this point onward, you know, real spoilers. But then I decided, bring it on, as long as it's a real credible spoiler. At this point, we still have over a year until Episode 7 comes out, and I think a few well-placed spoilers from JJ and crew, and that's not counting his special little messages for us, would do wonders at generating excitement, not only for the fans, but for everyone. So how about it, JJ? Can you give us something a little more substantial? You know, like maybe a title? That would be nice. Okay, well, that felt really good to get all that off my chest. Thanks for listening to my insights on spoilers. How about you? How do you feel about spoilers? We'd love to hear what you have to think about it, so drop us a line, tweet us, or email us. We would love to hear from you. Well, that's pretty much all I've got to say about spoilers for today. So until we meet again, may the Force be with you.
So, moving on to the Doctor Who episode that aired this week, actually aired earlier today here in Australia, simulcast, as I always point out, with the UK, which we are eternally grateful for down here in Australia. You know, for those of us who get up early in the morning, it's great to see the show at the same time as the UK, and then we can jump on, you know, Gallifrey Base or somewhere like that and, you know, talk to other fans. And, of course, on Twitter as well through the Who Wars account. That's all very cool stuff. And I've got to say that it's kind of strange that we've had a lot of, you know, quite hyped up episodes in recent times, and some of them really haven't delivered. I think Kill the Moon, particularly, when you look at the preview I read from Doctor Who magazine in a recent episode, or if you read that preview yourself, it was saying stuff like, you know, things are never going to be the same again, and we take away from that, oh gosh, something big is going to happen, and I guess they could maybe play that line, they could spin it as, well, things are never quite the same again because the moon collapsed, and then we got a new moon, and gosh, that's all new and interesting, but it's not the way I think most people read it, and it's been the same with some other episodes as well. They've been hyped up, and the trailers have been such that you think, oh gosh, this is going to be X, and we actually get why. Whereas going into this episode, you know, from the name down, I mean, Mummy on the Orient Express, and then we saw the trailer and it's the Orient Express in space. It looked like this was going to be a silly kind of episode, maybe just a filler kind of episode, a Doctor Who of the Week kind of thing. And, you know, that's quite wrong. Like, I guess probably a good example might be Dinosaurs on a Spaceship. When I first heard that name for one of the Matt Smith episodes, I was like, oh no, it was obviously a play on Snakes on a Plane, and the trailer made it look a bit silly, and yet the actual episode itself was okay. I mean, not fantastic, but okay. And this was similar, except that in this case, the episode was a bit more than okay, it was quite a good episode. So for something that wasn't really hyped, and something that I think a lot of us might have thought was going to be a silly filler piece, it was quite good. And let's start with the Doctor being the centre of attention again. Wasn't that good to see? You know, Stephen Moffat's got this theory on steroids that the companion is our way into the show, and it's really all about the companion. The Doctor's almost playing a bit part to the companion. I hate that point of view. I understand the companions have a role, but I watch a show called Doctor Who because I'm interested in the character Doctor Who. Could you imagine watching an Indiana Jones movie and it was all about Marion Ravenwood or, you know, whoever his companion was in that particular movie, Short Round maybe, and you're thinking, I'm here to watch Indiana Jones, why is it all about the other people? Or, I don't know, a James Bond movie, you go to a James Bond movie and it's all about someone else other than James Bond. That kind of stuff's ridiculous, and yet in Doctor Who, the writers over many, many years have gotten the free pass on it, and Stephen Moffat, as I say, has just amped it up on steroids. And we've had a lot of shows recently, I've mentioned this before, you know, in the Matt Smith era, I used to call it the Amy Pond show, and it's true. And so to see the Doctor the centre of attention in this episode was just fantastic. Speaking of companions, though, I guess we were sold a bit of a lie about Clara. She had a big blow-up at the Doctor at the end of the last episode and wandered off and said, go away, you know, in your lonely little box, or whatever the particular line was. And it seemed that that was that. We knew it wasn't going to be the end of them altogether, but we thought maybe for the next episode it's just a Doctor adventuring. And certainly the trailer for this episode made it seem that way. I think they were very clever to cut Clara out of that. So we saw them argue last episode. We saw a Clara-free trailer. But then as this episode got closer, we saw the Radio Times poster for this episode. It had, you know, Jenna Coleman's name on it. Someone commented about that on Twitter, and I said, oh, well, look, maybe she's just in it at the start or the end, you know, so that's why she's on the poster, but, you know, I don't think she's on the train. And yet there she was on the train. She was adventuring with the Doctor. We got the sense that it was maybe a couple of weeks since that argument, and that she had decided to have one last hurrah with the Doctor. Okay, cool. And so Clara's in this episode. There were a couple of soap opera-ish kind of moments between the two, but on the whole, and again, because the Doctor was the centre of attention in this episode, that was kind of put to the side. I think that really helped this episode, that again, we're focused on the Doctor, we're focused on the adventure, and, you know, what Clara's up to, or what gripe she's got this week, what win she wants to have this week, was put to the side. So I'm quite happy to say this early into the review, I think this was miles better than the previous episode, which I thought was fun, a bit silly, not so great. Of course, you've all heard Lex's opinion of the caretaker. She wasn't very enamoured with it at all. I think, you know, whether you really hated last episode or whether you thought it was just okay, I think you'd probably agree that this was a much better episode. I mean, the premise was interesting, the direction was interesting. I guess in some ways some of the characters were a bit, what would be the word, superfluous. You have all these experts on the train. We learn that the train has been filled with experts by the mysterious Gus. But only one of them was a real speaking character. And when the Doctor had them all working on the puzzle in the train car, they all sort of stood in the background and didn't speak, and that seemed a bit weird. And I think having one of them look like Albert Einstein was quite distracting. I'm sure that was deliberate. You saw him, he had the white moustache and the crazy hair. I'm sure someone thought that was really funny, like, oh, he's a scientist and he looks like Einstein, ha 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 ha. No, it was just kind of distracting. I'd rather, if they were going to be nondescript background characters, make them look nondescript. Several of them were, but the guy who looked like Einstein, he just stood out like a sore thumb. Anyway, I mentioned the premise being good, and I've seen some people online say that it was a murder mystery, sort of like a Columbo episode. Now, I don't know if any of you are actually old enough to remember Columbo. I hope you are. I hope at least some of you are. Often in Columbo, we'd know the murderer up front, or very close to the start of the episode, but then we'd need to figure out how and why. It was kind of a spin on murder mysteries rather than not knowing who it was until the end. You'd actually know who it was fairly early, but there were other things to find out. And so, yeah, I can see the Columbo comparisons there for sure. And the plot raised questions, and this is always a good thing. I mentioned earlier, who is Gus? You know, who is this mysterious Gus who gathered everyone on the train and was opening airlocks and jettisoning, you know, innocent people off into space and killing them to speed up the Doctor and the other scientists' work? I mean, that's some pretty cold stuff there, you know? So, I think Gus might be Missy, and I've seen a lot of people saying that online as well. What's interesting, though, is some people also think Gus might have been the train's engineer, Perkins. Which is an interesting way of looking at things, but heck, I've already seen people say that I think Perkins is a Time Lord. There's a thread on Gallifrey Base where people are talking about that at the moment, and I've commented that, you know, it seems whenever there's a slightly interesting or enigmatic character on Doctor Who these days, people are quick to jump on the, it's a Time Lord, almost in a similar way to when a strong female adversary or strong female character comes up, people are like, it's the Rani. It seems to be this thing that's getting hardwired into fans. And guys, girls, you've got to stop doing it. It does you a disservice to just assume that if someone's vaguely interesting, slightly mysterious or enigmatic, that they're a Time Lord. No, I don't think Perkins was a Time Lord. And I really don't think Perkins was Gus. I think the best guess is that Gus is maybe some manifestation of Missy. But speaking of Perkins, wasn't Frank Skinner's character nicely understated? I mean, Frank Skinner is a comedian. I don't know if a lot of people know this. Maybe people particularly in the US might not know this. Obviously, in the UK, everyone knows this. Here in Australia, it might be a mixed bag. I guess a lot of people here might not even know him at all. But I know him from doing, you know, a couple of different comedy shows, at least, that we've seen here over the years. And for a comedian to play that role in such an understated way, I thought was just really good. I believe Frank Skinner's actually a fan of Doctor Who, so he probably gets that fans might have been a bit like, oh, Frank Skinner, what's he doing in the show? And he probably knew the best way to counter that would be to just do a really nice, understated performance and have people go, oh, gosh, that was nice, that was understated, I didn't expect that, and it was actually quite good acting. Oh, you know, I think the best way to maybe counter people who don't like you being in a show is to put in a good performance and, you know, set them back on their heels a bit. In a similar way, if I can go off on a tangent, I think that's what will happen with Ben Affleck playing Batman. I mean, his casting was like the most controversial thing in geekdom you could imagine. Obviously, people listening to this will know exactly what I mean. And I think the best way Affleck is going to counter that is just to come out with a really great interpretation of Bruce Wayne and Batman, and people are going to come out of that Batman and Superman movie whenever it comes out, whether it's next year or whenever. I think it's got a long gestation period, actually. And say, wow, Affleck was great. I was wrong about Affleck. You know, this is obviously in a much bigger way to this Frank Skinner role, but I think the similarity is the same. I think what Skinner did here is what Affleck is going to do in Batman as well. As for the Mummy, meanwhile, the way it looked, the premise that only the people who are about to die could see it, you know. Capaldi's line, "Are you my mummy?" in the middle of it all, that was quite good as well. Oh yeah, the mummy is yet another sympathetic creature in Doctor Who. We're seeing a lot more of this. I guess they don't want to kill off or dispatch creatures who are just pure evil these days, these politically correct days. They want to have creatures who are scary and who might kill us but aren't actually always evil. Maybe there's someone we can feel sympathy for. And certainly with this, you know, ancient soldier or whatever the premise was, we felt that. So I just thought I'd mention that, that the mummy, for all its scariness and for all the stuff that surrounded it and, you know, why it would appear for 66 seconds and why only the dead could see it, etc., it did also have that sympathetic angle to it as well, which was at least interesting. So yeah, I was really enjoying this episode. Along it went, you know, it looked stylish. I think it must have been a fairly budget episode, being set on just the train and with, you know, some special effects. But it looked really good. Having the singer Foxes in it was an interesting situation, because I really like Queen, and having her sing a classic Queen song I thought was quite good. And the sort of jazz direction she took it in was nice. I must confess, when I first heard, oh, we're going to have pop singer Foxes in the show, here in Australia, I've got no idea who Foxes is. I don't think a lot of people would. I think she's probably a very UK kind of flavour of the month performer. So to hear, oh, we've got, you know, a flavour of the month performer in Doctor Who, I was a bit, oh, gosh, do we have to? But having her on there, quite understated, sung a bit of Queen, got off the stage, you know, literally and figuratively, that was fine. You know, it wasn't like, here's Foxes, or anything like that. Or, like some musicians try to do, she didn't try to act. There weren't any lines for her. She was just singing a song in the background, and we saw a bit of it, and it was nice, and then we moved on. That was quite cool. So, yeah, look, really enjoyed the episode, but, and this is what I've saved until last, we get to the end, and Clara is still lying. I'm sure everyone picked up on this. You know, she gets the call from Danny. He asks a question along the lines of, is it done? And she says, yes, mission accomplished. Now, that's a lie, because what she's saying to Danny is, yes, I've had my last adventure with the Doctor. That's it, mission accomplished, because that's what she has obviously told him. So she's lied to Danny, and then when she gets off the phone, the Doctor says, you know, what did he want? And Clara comes skipping down the stairs with a big smile on her face. He's fine with it. That's a lie. So she's just lied to Danny. She lies to the Doctor. Then she comes out with, it was his idea for me to stop, you know, adventuring with you, but he's changed his mind. Another lie. You know, she bald-facedly said that to the Doctor, that it was Danny's idea for her to stop, but he's changed his mind. No, he didn't. Huge lie. Clara obviously wants to keep adventuring. She's addicted. And there was actually a line before all these lies came up. I should have mentioned that there was a line about being addicted, and the Doctor said something along the lines of, you can't tell if something's an addiction until you try to give it up. Clara's had 2 weeks off, come with the Doctor for this last adventure, but she's clearly addicted. She can't give it up, to the point where she's lying to Danny, her boyfriend. She's lying to the Doctor, the man, you know, who's protecting her and showing her the universe and giving her all these great experiences that she would never have in a million years if it wasn't for him. She's lying to them both. So it comes back to what I've said in the past about Clara, you know, having a great fall coming in the future, some sort of breakdown, just something massive is going to happen. It has to. And I've pointed to Al from the Diddly Dumb podcast, who's also talked about this to a large degree in the last couple of their episodes. If it doesn't happen, I will be just so disappointed, because Clara is just being set up here in such a way, the control freak stuff, the lies, you know, she thinks she's really in control of her life and really cool, but she's not. She snapped last week, but here she's saying, you know, I'm better now, it was just a wobble. I think that was the word she used. It was just a wobble. I'm back. Everything's cool. But no, it's not. It's not cool when you're lying to the two people in your life, the two main people in your life. You're lying to them just to get ahead. No. Clara, what are you doing? I'll be very surprised at what happens at the end of this series or at Christmas time. I think Jenna Louise is leaving. But, well, I won't say too much here, but when you hear my review of the new 12th Doctor comic, I do have an alternate view on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'll save that for the review. All right, then. What did you think of the episode? All up, I'd give this a solid 8 out of 10. I thought this was great. I thought it was interesting, and it gets better on repeat viewings. And, yeah, please let me know what you thought. Twitter, email, Facebook, send me an MP3, whatever you like, and I'll put it up on next week's show. Alrighty then, let's get on to the next section. Alright, and on to the Star Wars Rebels episode of the week. This week it was an episode called Droids in Distress, and here to discuss it with me is my wife, Leo. Say hi, Leo.
Hello, Leo.
Very funny. Now, this episode can basically be boiled down to the crew of the Ghost intercept a shipment of weapons intended for the Galactic Empire. Along the way, they pick up C-3PO and R2-D2. They're on a secret mission from Bail Organa to stop these weapons falling into Imperial hands. The Rebels get chased by Agent Kallus from the ISB, while Zeb Aurelius deals with grief over the near extinction of his people. At the end, R2-D2 provides Bail Organa with some information about the Rebels and their activities. Now, Leo, did you like seeing C-3PO and R2-D2 return? I know you commented that when they first came in, their first scene, there was this strange bit of music that played.
Yeah, it was a bit more festive than I was expecting. It wasn't a standard Star Wars tune. I'm never really that excited when I see C-3PO and R2-D2, but that's just me. I know other people love them.
Right. And yeah, and even when we watched the episode for a second time, I noticed the music. I didn't notice it the first time around, maybe because you were too busy telling me about it. But the second time around, I thought, yeah, that music really is weird. And it only plays very briefly, then it stops. It's almost like an outtake or something.
Well, it seemed like it was supposed to be like a little theme tune for the droids. Oh, like we're supposed to get excited that we're seeing them for again or something. It only plays when they're boarding the public shuttle.
Yeah. Now, do you think it was a bit cheap to bring them into the series so soon, especially now that we learned Darth Vader? Oh, okay. Especially now that we learned that Darth Vader is going to appear in future edits of the first episode, Spark of Rebellion. So you do think it was a bit cheap to bring them in so soon?
I think it's cheap to have them there at all. I don't feel like it's their story. That their story is told in the movies. But, okay, they're there. I guess we have to make the most of their appearance and see how they fit in.
Right. I guess playing devil's advocate, maybe it's a good thing to get these playing pieces on the table early on so we don't go a season or two without them, and then suddenly when they get inserted, everyone says, ah, now you're pulling these guys out of the closet because, you know, your show's failing or something.
Well, fair enough. And they're the standard everybody knows who they are comic relief duo, so you've got to have them there at some point. I mean, because it wouldn't be Star Wars without 3PO and R2.
Right. Now, we also got some backstory on Zeb in this episode. We're learning about his species, the Lasat. We learned they've almost been wiped out. And we learned that it was largely done with disruptor rifles, which are the very weapon the crew of the Ghost are smuggling in this episode.
Yes. I was a little worried at first that they were going to copy Chewbacca's backstory for Zeb, but it didn't really pan out exactly the same.
Right. And in this episode, it's noted that these rifles can take down a ship, and it's hinted that it can do far worse to a flesh and blood being. So I went and did some extra research, and basically a disruptor rifle will disintegrate a flesh and blood being. So when they talk about these weapons doing worse to Zeb's people, I guess he has seen a lot of his friends and family perhaps ripped apart, disintegrated by these weapons, so you can sort of tell why he threw the weapon down in disgust when he sort of saw it was like, ugh, yuck.
Yeah, arguably that's worse than watching your people be enslaved for the Empire, so. On the point about the disruptor, though, I thought, if they're so terrible, why didn't they show us that when the walkers come down, when Kanan fires one on the Empire, the Imperials and the walker?
Well, I guess we don't see what happens to the guys inside. This is to flesh and blood that it will rip them apart at a molecular level. But to a metal machine, I guess it just does that rainbow effect, which now that you bring it up, I thought looked a little cheap. Rather than, you know, just a single colour, it was sort of like a rainbow, like stars and...
That was a bit weird. It was green and red, if I recall, instead of like a blue, like a forced lightning, a sort of effect that you would expect that electronics would give off when they are incapacitated.
Yeah, and it got me thinking, actually, these weapons... apparently so suitably gross. It's mentioned in the episode that they're banned, and I thought, well, who would ban them? So presumably they're so bad that even the Senate, which is hugely weakened at this point and in 5 years' time won't exist at all, even the Senate could get these things banned, even though some Imperials still want to use them. So they must be regarded as pretty damn bad if the Senate could actually push back on the Empire and get these banned.
Yeah, but on the same token, the Empire, it wants to use these as prototypes to mass produce them again, so clearly they don't care about what the Senate thinks in the first place, which might just be a point to show how weak the Senate actually is. It's just a token government at this point in the history.
Good point. I guess this was a very Zeb episode, because the next few things I've jotted down here to talk about involve Zeb as well, and that's Zeb and Agent Callus fight. And we learn that the weapon they're fighting with, which we saw Zeb use in the previous episode as well, is called a bow rifle, which is interesting because it doesn't look or isn't used like a bow, nor is it used like a rifle. It's more like the electrostaffs that General Grievous's guards use in Revenge of the Sith, you know, because it's a long pole with electricity of some kind on each end. Do you like the look of that weapon?
I like it, and I recall that in an old PlayStation game called Masters of Terras Kazi that Leia uses one of those weapons. Now, it might not have had the same name. I'm pretty sure it didn't, because when I heard bow rifle, I first heard bowcaster, when I thought, that's not a bowcaster. Chewbacca uses a bowcaster. It doesn't look like a rifle to me either. I was really kind of confused by the whole name thing, but... we have seen them before, and I think they're really cool. They're like lightsabers for non-Jedi, basically.
Yeah, I remember playing that game on PlayStation as well. I can't quite remember Leia having one. Maybe I didn't play as Leia all that often. Maybe that's why I can't remember.
Well, I think she has the Boosh outfit. There's two outfits for her, or whatever. One is where she's dressed up as the bounty hunter, and the other is where she's got the staff thing that made no sense, because we had never seen one like that in the Star Wars EU before that point. So that's why it stands out to me, because I thought it was kind of cool.
Gotcha. Now, there's obviously some history with Agent Callus having one of these bow rifles. It seems, if anything, Callus might become Zeb's nemesis, if he's had a hand in perhaps wiping out the Lasat. That's how he got this weapon. The same as the Inquisitor might become the nemesis of Ezra and Kanan. Can you see that being a possibility in the story? I know we've only had a couple of episodes so far.
At this point, I don't really have any idea about the Inquisitor or even Kanan and Ezra at this point. I feel like I know Zeb the most of the crew, which, you know, you're right, it's still pretty early days. And the episode was focused on him. I don't know if Callus would be specifically a nemesis to Zeb only. Maybe he'll be a constant thorn in the crew's side as they go along, and everyone will have their own little problem with him at some point. So I'm not really sure where he fits in yet.
Who are you liking in the crew so far?
I like Zeb. I really didn't think I'd like him. I thought at first he looked comical and silly. The purple fur and the green eyes just did not do it for me. But... in this episode, he's got layers, he's got personality. I like his old man sort of crankiness vibe, but I always like characters like that.
I think you just like Steve Bloom.
I'm used to him. And, you know, I like the fact that Zeb doesn't sound exactly like his other characters. You know, he always has a little bit of diversity. I mean, like, you know it's him. But it's not like Kanan's like, oh, Kanan's obviously James Vegas / whatever other characters he's done. I can't think right now. Whereas Zeb, you know, is obviously his own person. He doesn't sound exactly like Grunt, or he doesn't sound exactly like Ritlock in Guild Wars.
Yeah. All right. Now moving on, my pet theory for this early into Rebels, it's my pet theory that the ideal ending for the show in Season 5, 5 years from now, will be the team stealing the plans for the first Death Star and getting them into R2, perhaps for added effect, they might stay back and fight Darth Vader to buy R2 some time to get away. They'll probably lose their lives in the process, and that'll be the end of the show. And here in this episode, we've already met Bail Organa. He's met Kanan. He's used this alleged Jedi saying, the simplest gesture of kindness can fill a galaxy with hope, which basically says to me at least, hey, dude, I know you're a Jedi, but I'm not letting on. And we've had the whole team meet R2 and 3PO. So what do you think? Is it too early to make that call, or could that be the possible end to Rebels in, you know, 5 years from now?
Well, I'd like to see an ending like that. Is this before 3PO and R2 have their memory wipe?
I'd say 3PO's had his memory wiped because they asked for that at the end of Revenge of the Sith, and that was, you know, 15 years ago, I guess, at this point.
Right. Okay, because I was thinking maybe they just don't remember Kanan, and that, well, they could have had multiple wipes for all we know.
I think the vibe is that 3PO might get wiped from time to time, but R2 sort of doesn't. He's the little guy who knows everything but, you know, doesn't let on.
Right. That seems fitting.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to me, it's one way of not having the crew interfere in the timeline from A New Hope onwards, if you kill them off just before A New Hope starts. And yet, it would still tie their story intrinsically into the original trilogy if they end up being the spies who got the plans. I think it'd tie things together very neatly. I almost can't see them not doing it. It's so obvious to do.
I'm wondering if they do it intentionally, or if it's just kind of like, it's just one of their random jobs and it goes terribly bad at the end, and, you know, none of them knew exactly what they were in for. I mean, that would be interesting in my mind, but...
I don't know. Speaking of random jobs, do they strike you as the crew of the Serenity at times?
Oh, very much so. Very much so, especially in the comments Ezra made about how he already knew how to do thieving, and the way that they were running out of rations and supplies, and Kanan kind of screwed up. And I mean, the episode starts with them really just low on everything.
Yeah.
And that's so Serenity / Firefly.
Yeah, and the comment about we need money to keep this thing flying or whatever it was, it always could have come from Firefly.
Oh, yeah. The stories take place in the Outer Rim, don't they? So that's kind of like the fringes of the galaxy, and that's, you know, basically where Firefly takes place.
Yeah, I don't think Lothal's in the middle of, you know, the hip and happening part of the universe, that's for sure.
Well, I'm pretty sure they mentioned Governor Tarkin in the first episode, and he was governor of the Outer Rim.
Yeah, exactly. They called the shanty town Tarkin Town, so it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
All right, okay. Overall, what did you think of the episode?
Well, it definitely felt short, but that's because it was short compared to the first double episode.
Yeah, I said that last episode. I said, you know, these are going to feel short, both because of that first episode being twice the length, and also just because of their pacing. Like, you know, that hour felt like half an hour when we watched that first episode. Now, half an hour, well, it's not even half an hour, it's 22 minutes. And when it moves really quickly, it feels like, you know, 15 or something.
Well, it's better than moving too slow. So.
I guess so.
You know, I liked it. I liked that it focused on Zeb, and I hope that future episodes focus on the rest of the crew. I'm particularly excited about Sabine and seeing more of her. She has some great lines and expressions. Her facial expressions in this episode were really good with her interacting with Zeb.
Yeah, I think we're going to have episodes coming up where it's, oh, this is the Zeb episode. Well, we just had that one. This is the Kanan episode. This is the, you know...
This is the episode that explains why Agent Kallus is involved. Maybe, I don't know. Hoping there. So far, I feel like the characters that I should know the most about are the ones I know least about.
Well, who are they?
Ezra and Kanan.
Okay. But I just knowing you, I'd say you probably don't mind that because you don't want this to be a really Jedi sort of story anyway.
Oh, absolutely not. And that reminds me of something I was going to say earlier. I was really happy that there were no lightsabers in this episode at all.
Yeah.
The electro-staff thing, whatever we're calling it, kind of replaced that. But that battle felt a lot more personal than the idealistic battle between a Jedi and a Sith, or a Jedi and a Stormtrooper, or whatever. So I was kind of excited that, you know, they're not always going to mention Jedi and lightsabers and stuff like that, because they really shouldn't, given the time period.
Yeah, and I hope it continues like that, too. I don't want to see lightsaber duels every episode.
I think that what makes a lightsaber duel special is that it's not something that happens every day.
Yeah, well, exactly. Okay, overall, I like the episode. There's not much to compare it to. We've only had the 1 hour special before this, so I guess I'd say it's a solid 7 or 8 out of 10. But again, I don't really have any sort of touchstones or comparison points. It was a nice little adventure, good backstory on Zeb. It was fun to see R2 and 3PO. There wasn't really much to dislike.
I felt like some of the stuff with R2 felt a little forced, like when he started following the other droid.
Chopper?
Yeah, Chopper. But other than that, like, I'll get over it. I just don't, I'm just not a fan of those two, of the droids. I just don't have any feelings for them at all. So, oh. That's just me, though.
Fair enough, fair enough. Before we go, one thing that just popped into my mind, and I know you'll probably enjoy answering this. Agent Callus's helmet, how Roman is it?
Pretty freaking Roman. I noticed that he didn't have any other, like, armor on. It was just the helmet and just the little sort of back chest piece thing that looked a lot like my agent from Tor, actually. I kind of liked his minimalistic battle armor. The only thing about Callus that really throws me off is his voice.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to fit him. Makes him sound a bit bigger and angrier than he really actually looks.
Interesting. Well, I'm sure we'll see a lot more of him, so get used to him.
Yeah, well, I guess I have to.
All right, Leo, from your studio down the hallway from me, thank you for joining us on Who Wars this week.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe we'll have you back again.
Maybe you will. Maybe you won't.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Howdy, folks. It's Kate. I'm back this time to give you a new segment on the show that I like to call Secondhand Star Wars. Before I get started, though, let me explain a little bit about what this segment is going to involve. So if you're like me, you love Star Wars and you love getting a great deal. So what I've been doing is scouring the local thrift shops, garage sales, antique stores, etc. to find lost and hidden Star Wars treasures. And basically the only ground rules that I have when I do this, it has to be something that catches my interest, something that's really good quality, and also something that's not crazy expensive, you know. I'm not particularly a rich person, so I like to find a good deal when I can. So without further ado, here are a few of my Star Wars finds. Okay, so first up, I found a couple of really cool Darth Vader t-shirts. The first one is a black shirt with Darth Vader's silhouette, and on the inside it's kind of this greenish color with Force Moon of Endor, and then it's got an AT-ST walker, or as I like to call it, a chicken walker. And then underneath that, it's got the Return of the Jedi movie billing information, you know, all the actors' names and production and all that stuff. So that's a pretty neat shirt. The other one's also a black shirt, and it's got about a trading card-sized image on the front of Darth Vader from Empire Strikes Back, and it says, "Embrace the dark side." And it's also got this pretty cool blue glittery border and the Star Wars logo in the corner. So that one's also a pretty cool shirt. I like that one a lot too. On to the next pieces. Next up, I've got A New Hope and The Empire Strikes Back original radio dramas on cassette tape. So they're the original thing. And fortunately, I do have a cassette tape player, so I'm able to play them, but I also have a friend who was nice enough to convert it into MP3s for me. And sadly, it didn't have Return of the Jedi, so that would have been nice to have all three of them, but, you know, I did actually just purchase that one, I think, on iTunes or whatever. But yeah, I highly recommend the radio dramas. If you've never heard them before, go out there and get those right away. They are so good. Because they actually have Mark Hamill reading as Luke Skywalker. They have Anthony Daniels as C-3PO. And The Empire Strikes Back even has Billy Dee Williams. as Lando, of course, and then we've got John Lithgow as Yoda. And I love John Lithgow. He does an excellent Yoda. So, yeah, if you haven't heard these, or even if you have heard them, go out there and listen to them again. I love these radio dramas. They're so good. All right. So next up, it's a book. The book called The Crystal Star. Now, as I said on an earlier podcast, I haven't really read much of the EU, but I would like to. And thrift shops are an excellent resource for that because you can get so many Star Wars books for really cheap. And so this book, The Crystal Star, I really don't know much about it other than what's on the cover. It looks like it's probably not that much further after Return of the Jedi. But yeah, if you're into the EU, if you could just maybe let me know if this one's any good. If it is, I'll probably start it sooner rather than later. And also, let me know, like, where exactly does this fit in with the other books in the EU? That would be good to know. Next up, it's a neat little greeting card thing called a Pop Shot pop-up greeting card. And so basically when I was in the store, I just zeroed in. I saw the Star Wars logo and I took a chance and I bought it. And on the front, it's got like a generic Star Wars scene with Darth Vader and the Emperor and some TIE fighters and the stars in the background, you know. You open it up and bam, you got R2-D2 and C-3PO in 3D on their way to Jabba's palace in Tatooine with the text that says, "We've been through a lot together." So this really was a great surprise. I wasn't expecting that at all. I just love this card so much. I love R2-D2 is one of my favorite characters. So that one was really special for me. So the last one I'll be showcasing for today is the one that probably made me the happiest. It's this really nice collector's tin of the art of Ralph McQuarrie. Yeah. So yeah, it's 20 all metal collector cards all inside this nice collector's tin. And they're all there. They're all sealed. I'm opening it right now, if you can hear that. Yeah, they're all sealed in their plastic sleeves and all of them are there. And as Star Wars fans, we all know how awesome Ralph McQuarrie is. His artwork is just so incredible, and it's so neat to see the different ideas he had. And you can even tell, you know, especially with Rebels coming out, a lot of the influences from there, especially the, you know, his original concept for Chewbacca and then what Zeb turned out to be. So it's just really neat to look at all these cards and see these ideas and how his brain must have worked. It's incredible. But yeah, I was so happy to get this. And I got this one at a garage sale. It was a mom who said her son was moving out of town and he was actually selling a bunch of sci-fi stuff. So I pretty much made out like a bandit that day. So thank you, guy who was moving to Lake Havasu. Your stuff is in good hands. So if you're interested in seeing any of these things, you can check out the Tumblr I've started called Secondhand Star Wars. So I think it's secondhandstarwars.tumblr.com. And then also I'll be tweeting these pictures once the episode airs with the hashtag Secondhand Star Wars. What about you? Do you have some awesome Star Wars treasures that you've found? Go ahead and post them on Twitter with the hashtag Secondhand Star Wars. And let's share our awesome finds. Maybe we can even get that hashtag trending. Well, that's going to do it for this installment of Secondhand Star Wars. Check back next month for more awesome Star Wars treasures. Until then, may the Force be with you. Hey everyone, it's me again. I hope you've enjoyed hearing from the correspondents that have been added to the Who Wars show. One of the great things about being in a fandom like Star Wars is hearing from people with various thoughts or opinions. We all have this common bond, but new or different perspectives can really help to broaden our appreciation and make us love our fandom even more. Do you have something to say that you'd like other fans to hear, especially along the Star Wars side of things? Rob is still looking for people to join the Who Wars team. You don't need any podcasting experience, just a voice and a microphone. So if this is something that sounds interesting to you, drop Rob a line. You can reach him at hello@whowars.net.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Planet Earth. We hope you enjoyed your trip to the moon. it was a pity that chemistry, physics, and biology just couldn't come along for the ride. I guess they were stuck in some other dimension. Let us know if you want a refund. Maybe we can erase the history of this episode ever occurring. Oh wait, I'm being a bit extreme. But I, for one, did enjoy my trip to the moon. It was one heck of a ride. There were scary bacteria things. And at one point, the doctor jumps into amniotic fluid with a spray bottle and a yo-yo. That moment goes down into prize-winning Doctor Who history. I don't know what the prize would be, but it's something magnificent. I think that Clara wasn't entirely in the wrong for the way she behaved at the end, except for the part where she threatened to hit the doctor until he regenerates. That's never cool. She should get voted off the TARDIS for saying that. I don't have to think it's happening. She's going. Maybe the doctor knew that she would react in this way and wanted to test her, push her buttons until she did explode so he would have a good reason to vote her off the TARDIS. Speaking of votes, how cool was it that humanity got to vote on whether or not they would keep the moon? They made an awful decision, but how cool was it that the doctor had kind of lifted off the stabilizers of humanity's bicycle? Okay, let me back up a second and share my story, which is exactly the same as a million other humans on this planet. Okay, so I was on my bicycle, and my dad was behind me with a stabilizer thing, like a big stick. And he lifted off the stick, and I looked behind me, and my dad was miles away, and I kind of really freaked out and got really, really angry, stupendously angry. But of course, my dad would never have known that or felt any of my rage, unfortunately, because I was miles away. And so I was really, really angry that he put me in horrendous danger. But then I realized that I had to survive, and I somehow managed the pedals. I was riding the bicycle on my own, and from that moment I learned how to ride a bicycle, for which I am very grateful. So thank you, Dad, and thank you, Doctor, on behalf of humanity. I think that was a great moment. Tough love, but it got humanity somewhere, and that was a beautiful thing to see. Also, the moon creature really was beautiful. Sniffle. But back to Clara's side of things. Some people can take tough love, and Clara is just not one of them. She needs those stabilizers, and if you take them away from her, she'll get really, really angry and threaten to hit you till you regenerate. And if you don't regenerate, well, that's tough. So that was scary. Although she did say some things that made a lot of sense. Like how the doctor, his opinion was totally valid. He might not be human, but he uses the moon enough. He is so old, and he has traveled to Earth so many times that I am sure he's used the moon in a time span that equates to longer than the average human's lifespan. So that's significant. He deserves an opinion. Humanity depends on him so much that he should have been there. And it was also oddly political, this message about pro-life. It related to the question of whether women should choose to have abortions. And, so that was kind of boldly political and kind of uncomfortable. With all those insinuations that this episode was about an unplanned pregnancy, it made me uncomfortable because babies scare me. So I guess one point of the episode was that, in this context, fathers should have more say in abortions, and they should be supportive, I guess. Which makes me, once again, putting the doctor in the role of a dad. Now, I don't know whether the episode on a whole was making a definitive message being on one side of the pro-choice or pro-life. I think it kind of argued both sides, so maybe it was just supposed to be a piece to bring up that conversation in society. And so here it turns out we have Doctor Who urging us to be involved in politics, I suppose. Huh. Moving on, please. I think we've reached that point where we can now all say that Clara is definitely going. Her and the doctor just don't get along anymore. She needs those stabilizers. The doctor doesn't want to work with somebody who needs those stabilizers. She is gearing towards that point in her life where she's going to stick on Earth and far, far away from the doctor. Ain't it exciting and new to move on to new companions? You know, it's funny, though. I never pictured Clara as being the character that needed stabilizers, that needed the doctor to feel safe. I always thought that she was the leaf blowing on the wind, kind of going freely, just falling. That's how it is, though. All right, I'm done talking. Bye. See you next week. I mean, listen to me next week. Bye.
Okay then, on to Doctor Who comics, and the first of the two Doctor Who comics I'm going to look at in this episode of Who Wars is Doctor Who, The Tenth Doctor, Revolutions of Terror Part 3, which is also issue number 3 of the Tenth Doctor series from Titan Comics. The writer is Nick Abadsis and the artist is Elena Casagrande. Now, as some of you might know, because you saw me talk about it on Twitter or maybe other places, I actually own some artwork from Elena Casagrande. I think she's a great artist, and I think Nick Abadsis is a fine writer. Indeed, there is nothing intrinsically wrong with this issue of Tenth Doctor from Titan Comics. However, at the end of reading it, and we'll get to the story in a minute, at the end of reading it, I felt I'm not enjoying this as much as the 11th Doctor series from Titan. We had a look at an 11th Doctor comic a couple of episodes ago on Who Wars. And I think one potential reason for that is the 11th Doctor series, while the first three issues have had a linked storyline, they've been quite distinct, almost standalone stories in and of themselves. The first was about the 11th Doctor finding his companion and a mini sort of adventure there. Then they went off into the future to this planet and went to a fun theme park, which actually wasn't so fun in the end. And in the third one, they ended up in Mississippi, but they took a character who was based on David Bowie with them, and that was all very weird. All three of them have had a link, but all three of them have been like standalone stories. I think here, being the third part of the same story, with the 10th Doctor running around New York City with his new companion, Gabriella Gonzalez, I don't want to say it's dragged a bit because the story has moved along, but it's almost like, hey, in this other series, in this 11th Doctor series, we've already seen three very distinct, unique type things happening, whereas here it's just been the same story all along. So I think when I don't feel as fondly towards this issue as I do towards the 11th Doctor comic, I think it is largely because of that. The story here is quality. And, I mean, let's get into the story. The Doctor in the last episode was leaping through this portal to another world where the Cerebrivores, the creatures in this story, were coming from, and he meets up with a scientist there, and she explains that they had basically destroyed their own world by inventing the Cerebrivores, which is, you know, quite an interesting concept. You know, hubris has killed this whole world by creating the Cerebrivores as telepathic weapons. And I think, wow, that's really cool. And just as the Doctor gets to his traditional come with me moment with this scientist, you know, she's basically the last of her people. And he says, you know, come with me. You can travel and see things. And, you know, clearly you're not an idiot like the rest of your race were. She actually turns into a creature herself and attacks him. And, wow, what a way to go. But, yeah, look, this story has a lot to recommend it. Really, really don't get me wrong on that. You know, Gabriella Gonzalez seeing the TARDIS for the first time, the dialogue, which you can just imagine David Tennant saying, even the style of story, I know this is a very hard thing to sort of quantify, but even the type of story it is feels very 10th Doctor. So this is a quality comic. But again, compared to the 11th Doctor range, I'm not sure that starting off with a three-part story that doesn't sort of change all that much was maybe the way to kick it off. It will be interesting to see how the 12th Doctor comics go. But that's okay. I guess three issues is better than starting it with a four-issue story or a five-issue story or something along those lines. Suffice to say, without going into too many spoilers, the Doctor saves the day. And we're quite wrong-footed near the end, where it looks like the Doctor isn't going to take Gabriella Gonzalez with him. She is almost pleading with him to come in the TARDIS with him. And the 10th Doctor says, thing is, Gabriella Gonzalez, I like you. traveling with me can be very dangerous, and in the past, recently, friends of mine have been hurt. I don't want that to happen to you. And it does seem, I thought we were being wrong-footed, and oh, this character we thought was going to be a companion, and this character that the Doctor Who legacy game on mobile devices had added her as a companion. Oh my god, we've been wrong-footed. She's not actually going to be a companion at all. But then he relents, and of course she's going to be a companion for just one trip, apparently. Oh, we'll see how long that lasts. And that's the end of the story. So, again, without going into too many spoilers, I think it does sum the story up well. Perhaps this story could have been told in two issues. It would have been a very fast-paced kind of story if it was. Three issues is probably its right length, but, gosh, was starting off a new 10th Doctor line with a three-issue story the right way to go? I'm not sure. Again, when I compare it to the 11th Doctor, I think the storylines are probably quite comparable, but just the 11th Doctor seems to have had so much more scope and breadth than this story just set in New York City and brief snatches of another distant, far-flung planet through that portal. So, on the whole, look, a solid 3 out of 5, maybe a 3.5 out of 5. If you're a fan of the 10th Doctor and you're collecting this range, I don't think you'll be disappointed by this issue at all. But I call it like I see it, and just in comparing the two lines, soon to be three lines, from Titan, that's just how I feel at the moment with where these three issues of 10th Doctor and three issues of 11th Doctor are at the moment. Clear as mud? Good. Write me a line, Twitter, email, Facebook, whatever you like. If you've been reading the 10th Doctor range and you agree with me, or if you disagree with me, it's all good. I'll put it on the show. We can have a great conversation about it. That's what fandom is all about. Alrighty then. Now it's time for our second Doctor Who comic of the episode. And this is a special one. It's the 12th Doctor, number one. Alrighty, as I said a moment ago, it's now time to look at the 12th Doctor, issue number one for Titan Comics. Yes, this means we now have a 10th, 11th, and 12th Doctor range of comics. If you've not seen this one in the shops yet, that's okay. It hasn't come out yet. If you've been lucky enough to be at New York Comic Con, you may have seen some issues. Otherwise, yeah, you won't have seen it yet. So by the magic of Who Wars, I'm going to review something that's not out yet in the shops. And I'm really happy to be doing this because, as you would know from my comments on Peter Capaldi's first series as the Doctor, I am absolutely loving his performance. And I've got to say, this comic from Titan, just like the 10th and 11th Doctor ranges, captures the spirit, the character, the dialogue of the Doctor really, really well. This is the Peter Capaldi Doctor in comic form. Now, before we rip into it, I've got to say something about the choice of companion here. It's Clara. Now, in comics, as a rule, the standalone series away from Doctor Who magazine, it's been very, very common for the Doctor to adventure with non-TV companions. They invent some other companions, they invent a period of time where the Doctor might have had these other companions, and they go with that. So that's interesting in and of itself, that here the Doctor has a TV companion rather than a made-up companion. I mean, the 10th and 11th Doctor ranges from Titan both have made-up companions, so why not here? Also, it's interesting because when you look at the fine print for this issue, it's Doctor Who, the 12th Doctor, number one, November 2014. So this is the November issue of the comic. If, by all accounts, Clara is leaving the show in December in the Christmas issue, then this opening storyline in the 12th Doctor range won't yet be over by the time she leaves the show. Or is that a hint that Clara might be continuing? I'm really not sure now, because it does seem rather weird to have a comic series with Clara as the companion when, in a few months' time, there may be no Clara at all on TV, particularly if she's killed off. Wouldn't that be weird if she gets killed off at Christmas time, and yet in January and February and March, you're reading the 12th Doctor comic with Clara as the companion? I guess it means two things. One, Clara does not actually go at Christmas, and this is our first big pointer at that. or two, Clara does go at Christmas, and I guess they want to have a familiar face in the comic book before we see a new companion on TV. I guess they can't introduce the new TV companion in the comic book, so they've got to do something. Why they aren't just using a generic companion, however, is a bit of a mystery to me. Both on two levels. As I said earlier, it's uncommon for comics like this to use a TV companion, and it seems that Clara will be gone. So why are they doing it? I'm very interested. I probably spoke about that for a little longer than I intended, but I hope I'm getting the message through that there's something a little strange going on here. Also something, I guess, a little strange for someone who's watching the current series, and as of recording this, I've only seen up to Kill the Moon, which ended with Clara absolutely ranting and raving and not wanting anything to do with the Doctor over again. Here, Clara and the Doctor are adventuring like old buddies. Sure, there's a bit of banter. Sure, we have the familiar kind of feel for, you know, Capaldi talking to her in a particular way and her reacting, but it's all fairly mild kind of stuff. And you get the feeling that this is a Capaldi and Clara who have moved on well from the period we've seen in the series so far. I don't know what's going to happen in the next, you know, six episodes, but suffice to say, this feels like it is at a later stage in their relationship, possibly even beyond what happens in the final episode of the series. Maybe they're adventuring here between the final episode in the series and the Christmas special. I don't know. We'll have to see what happens. Anyway, the story is called Terraformer, and the writer is Robbie Morrison, known to many, many comic book fans. Equally, the artist Dave Taylor will be known to many comic book fans as well. Both of them have done work for 2000 AD, which is where a lot of people may know them from. The story kicks off with a robot and the man flying around in a spaceship looking over a jungle, and the man is complaining a bit. He's complaining about, you know, one little flaw in my fjord design, and they stuck me on biosphere analysis. Is that fair? And instantly, you know, someone talking about designing fjords, I'm getting a real Douglas Adams kind of feel from Hitchhiker's Guide. That's greatly appreciated by me, and I'm sure will be by many of the sci-fi fans out there. Then, of course, there's a twist with the robot and this man. I won't go into spoilers here. I'm trying not to do that in my comic book reviews. And it's all quite scary before the equivalent of the opening titles, which is the title page, where we learn the name of the story and the artist and the writer and so on. And then into the story proper. And it's a very interesting tale of a very rich man who is terraforming a planet, formerly an ice planet, where Clara was going to do some skiing. And now it's a lush tropical forest. The Doctor and Clara come across all sorts of strange wildlife before being captured, essentially, and taken to this rich man who is obviously having some trouble with this planet that he's terraformed. As the Doctor points out, there are temperatures escalating at both poles. The glaciers are melting at quite a terrifying rate. Seismic activity is off the chart in every continent. He says to the guy, "You're heading for a global cataclysm, Professor. I'd run away, if I were you, very fast." So this planet is in danger. The Doctor is needed. It's a very deeply kind of Doctor Who script. And then we have the Doctor and Clara going down into the depths of this planet, into the bowels of the planet, initially rescuing some guys down there, before the Doctor comes across a signal that is Gallifreyan in origin. Now that's very interesting, because we see, unless it's a big sort of season finale or some sort of big episode on TV, we don't get a lot of sort of Gallifreyan stuff. And in these Titan series, we have that Time Lord popping up in the Matt Smith comic, and here we have the Doctor finding a signal that's Gallifreyan in origin. He's saying millennia ago, the Time Lords basically established an early warning system, a series of satellite beacons that would rove the galaxies to detect threats, you know, to universal harmony, disruptions in time and space, and other inexplicable phenomena. Obviously, this planet being terraformed is one of those things, and this ancient Time Lord signal has picked up on it, and the Doctor's now picked up on the signal. And as they investigate, they come across what looks like a very, very deadly lava creature, a very similar creature to what we saw attack the man at the very start of the comic, the man who had been designing the fjords. So it's intriguing. There's not a lot more to go on. This is just setting up the story. again, the Capaldi Doctor comes across very much as the Capaldi Doctor. Clara and the Doctor's relationship feels a lot like the one they've been having on TV, but not to the extent that Clara's blowing up and not wanting to adventure with him. This feels like the Doctor and Clara sometime down the line. Does that mean they're continuing on television, though, or not? If they're not, why didn't the comic book just go for a generic companion like we have in the 10th and 11th Doctor lines? Unknown. So, aside from the mystery in this story itself of what this lava creature is and how the Time Lord device is involved and all that good stuff, I'm also intrigued in a broader sort of way as to whether this is a clue as to maybe Clara's sticking around in the show. I don't know. Anyway, what do you think? I know you won't have read this particular issue, but if you've braved the spoilers and heard me talking about it here, what do you think about what I've been talking about? What do you think about reading the Capaldi Doctor in a comic book like this? Get in touch with me in all the usual ways. Okay, so here we are at the end of the 7th Who Wars. I hope you really enjoyed it. I know myself and the team really have a lot of fun putting these episodes together. And if you're sitting out there with an iTunes account, we'd really love to hear your feedback, even if it's just a sentence or two and a rating. It really helps boost us up there on iTunes. It helps other people like yourself find the show. If you do have iTunes, it would be greatly appreciated if you could do that. Plus, of course, get in touch with us the usual ways, email, Twitter, Facebook, all of those are covered in the credits package, and let us know what you think of the show, ask questions, record an MP3 of yourself, and we'll put that on the show. Anything you'd like. Remember, we're still looking for correspondence. If you've got something to say about Doctor Who or Star Wars on a regular or semi-regular basis, get in touch. We'll get you on the show. This show is all about grassroots fandom for Star Wars and Doctor Who. It's not a clique. It's not about, you know, three or four people who just know each other and that's it. It's about getting anyone involved who's got something to say and wants to be involved. And that's the only way I'd ever run a show. So please don't be shy. Everyone should have a voice. Everyone should get involved. And that's all there is to it. All right. I'll see you in episode 8 of Who Wars. I'm sure next Sunday will come quicker than you think. Until then, take care. Have a great week. And we'll talk to you soon.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.